गुरुर्ब्रह्मा गुरुर्विष्णु गुरुर्देवो महेश्वरः गुरु साक्षात् परब्रह्मा तस्मै श्री गुरवे नमः। ओम सहना भवतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै। ओम शांति शांति शांति। Perhaps a speciality, if we may call it so, of bhakti is the use of symbols. And again, neither oriental nor accidental or occidental, throughout the world we have used some kind of symbol or other to remind ourselves of the object of contemplation, God, cosmic consciousness, cosmic being, supreme bliss. Those of you who have read a very interesting book called The Source by Michener might remember that he mentioned that even in prehistoric Middle East, they used a monolithic stone pillar type of thing to represent God. Is it necessary? No. Is it helpful? Yes. It is not indispensable. One can do without it. And since that time, people have struggled to get away from it. And when they get away from it, they invent something new. They abolish one thing, and then immediately they get into something else. I need a symbol. I need to look at what I am contemplating. Before I can learn how to look within, I must know how to look. If I don't even know how to look, how do I know what it is to look within? If I don't know how to love someone whom I can touch, who can feel, whom I can smell, whom I can taste, if I'm a cannibal, how do I know what it is to love all? If I don't know what it is to love and what it is to commune with someone and learn the essence there, I must learn to love but learn to love the essence. I must learn to communicate, but learn to communicate with the essence, not just the form. So start from the form and get into the essence. This has been the approach of all mystics. Start with the form and from the form, with the help of the form, with the use of the form, and then get into the essence. Don't stop with the form, but don't try to jump into the essence unless you are capable of doing so. Here and there in mystic literature, one does encounter a Buddha who had no use for any form. He could sit there and he could go straight through, right through into his consciousness, eliminating all the other rubbish. And for those of us who went to visit the Scientology group yesterday, it is said that the Buddha was able, merely without any e-meter, without any auditor, with nobody's help, he was able to go right through the series of his own past incarnations. He was not interested in getting rid of fear or jealousy or things like that. But he was interested in finding the root cause of the problem of birth and death, the whole cycle of incarnation, reincarnation. What is it that compels me to embody myself? What is it that gives rise to this personality? He was interested in answering that question And he went right back, and eventually came to this ageless, beginningless ignorance. And suddenly the whole thing falls away. And he says, "Ha, I found out the truth. Now there shall be no more embodiment." It's possible for a Buddha. But if you suddenly have a grandiose illusion that you are also a Buddha, we'll try. Good luck. We are not jealous. Sit down under the tree, and Buddha is supposed to have taken a vow. You have seen some pictures of Buddha touching the earth like this. That was the moment when Buddha took a vow. Till I reach enlightenment, I will not get up from this seat. You'll try that. That may last for about 2 hours maximum if you are a very strong-willed person. We are not Buddhas. We are not Ramana Maharshi. The other person whose story I narrated the other day, Dakshinamurti, who remained silent and showed the Chin Mudra, and the other four great sages were enlightened, I can hold it for the next 2 hours. Nothing may happen. Either to me or to you. Except that my shoulders may start giving out. It is said that in one Upanishad, there is a story of a guru and a disciple. And the guru uses the word tattvamasi, the word that, the word the self, 9 times. And with a certain illustration. And after the 9th utterance, the disciple became enlightened. And since that time, it is considered part of the sannyas ceremony. That if she is going to give me sannyas, I sit at her feet and she says tattvamasi, and I say I am aham brahmasmi. She says it 9 times, I say it 9 times. And we get up and walk away, that's all. Nothing happened. Of course nothing happened. So it's rather tricky to bring in the example of Buddha, Ramana Maharshi and all those things. They said no images are necessary. One must be able to look straight into the essence, into the truth. My God, marvelous. And when you point out such instances, the simple devotee who still feels the need for these images, doesn't want to argue with you, fight with you, quarrel with you, that's considered a waste of time, which is true. And he merely says, "Oh, the Buddha was like me before, in a previous incarnation. Ramana Maharshi was also like me in a previous incarnation. He was also struggling. And when because he had achieved a very high state of evolution, before he took birth as Ramana Maharshi, he didn't need all those things." This is the argument used for in the case of people who say no guru is necessary. You had reached such marvelous, wonderful state of evolution before, so that you did not need a guru. That's okay, that's marvelous, beautiful. We have no quarrel with that. If you felt you had no need for a guru, marvelous, wonderful. But you still are my guru. That's the attitude. It's a very simple and beautiful attitude. He doesn't need an image. That's very good. God bless him. I need a symbol. Well, good. And he also has the same attitude. If I go to him and he says, "Sit and meditate, Om Tat Sat," and I come and tell him, "Guruji, it doesn't seem to be possible. May I have a picture of Om?" He says, "Okay, all right." "Guruji, even that is a bit, impersonal. May I keep your picture in front of me and meditate?" He says, "All right." I am on a certain level and this is good for me. and you are on a certain other level, that is good for you. As I said right in the beginning, this is the crux of the whole, not only yoga philosophy, but particularly bhakti, that you are allowed to use any symbol you like, any object you like, any symbol you like. I don't think I mentioned it here, somewhere else. I even know of one family in Ceylon whose only god was their own father. And they had an enormous, twice life-size portrait of him in their puja room. And they used to meditate upon this picture of the father, worship that father. Why not? What's wrong with that? It may be distracting, well, if you are sincere and if you are earnest, you realize when it becomes a distraction. As someone said, that which strengthens you in the beginning may strangle you later if you are not careful. It strengthens you in the beginning and then it might begin to strangle you. Even human love, human affection. And there, it's only your own sensitivity that's going to tell you. When it is a strengthening aid, which I need, and when it has become a strangling obstacle, which should drop away now. Nobody else can help me here. When I need strength, I use the symbol, I use the technique. And I'm watching all the time, so that it doesn't become a strangling obstacle. When the need has gone, it drops away. Why did the prehistoric person use the monolithic stone as a symbol to focus his attention? I didn't bring it now. I'll bring it in the afternoon and show you. I've also got one. And those of you who have been to India, I don't think it's here. You have seen what is known as a Shivalingam? Just a piece of monolithic stone. The word lingam means just that, a symbol. And also, it also means a characteristic symbol. Or a distinguishing mark. All these meanings, all these are meanings of the word lingam. A distinguishing mark, a characteristic symbol. But then, the characteristic symbol of a man is phallus. And therefore it was extended to cover phallus. It doesn't mean the lingam means only phallus, no. Lingam means a distinguishing mark. And then suddenly the two became confused. And some people loved it because of that, some people hated it because of that. We have nothing whatsoever to do with that. There is a passage in one of the it's a Vedic passage, a passage from the Vedas, where it says, Angushtamatra Purushontaratma Sada Jananam Hriye Sannivishtaha. What is the self? How should I meditate upon it? That is, how do I focus my mind, focus my attention in such a way that the attention doesn't wander? And at the same time it is turned within. How shall I meditate upon the self? And the Guru said, Angushtamatra Purusho Antaratma Sadana Jananam Hriye Sannivishtaha. Meditate upon the self in the form of a thumb, And they even gave it the proper dimension. The thumb of a newborn baby, not as big as my thumb. So it must be the thumb of a newborn baby. And meditate upon the thumb as if it is in your heart. And the heart is not on the left side, but on the right side, the spiritual heart. The thumb, the little thumb of the newborn baby, in the region of your heart. Now it's easy to focus the attention. And the thumb looks like phallus, the lingam too, the same phallic symbol. There's a lady called Miss Mayo who popularized it in India. And she was the guest of the Viceroy of India at that time, and so she became an authority immediately. And even the very learned Indians quote her nowadays. Miss Mayo said that the lingam is a phallic symbol. All that looks like is a phallic symbol. Aeroplane also. Jet plane. Some such silly idea, when it gets hold of you, it doesn't leave you very easily. The same monolithic stone as a lingam, as a visible symbol, as a distinguishing mark on which I can focus my attention, and the attention doesn't waver. I learn to see it outside. I learn what it is to see outside. And when I see it outside, I realize it is not outside. What I am seeing is not outside. It's possible Robin is sitting there. Possible. I'm not sure. What I am seeing is not this girl sitting there. But what I am seeing is the image that forms on my retina. That's all that I can see. That is what is actually seen. Reason why? Even if she is sitting there, if I become blind, I am unable to see because there is no image on the retina. Simple. As simple as that. How do I know that I am not seeing her sitting there? How do I assert that I am seeing? What I am seeing is the image that is formed on my retina. Because even if she is there, if the image is not formed on the retina, I don't see her. So, I first have the external symbol to provoke this image on the retina. And then I realize I am not seeing outside, seeing happens inside, within me. And from there on it's an inward adventure. The same the yoga process or meditation or contemplation or whatever you wish to call it. Self-knowledge. Then there were, this is one, the basic factor in what is known as idol worship. Nobody worships an idol. It's silly, stupid. They even had a very beautiful practice. And this is known as Parthiva Linga Puja. Don't worry about the words. I'll explain to you what it is. This is known as Parthiva Linga Puja. Everyone, it was obligatory on everyone to do some kind of worship before even taking your meal. You know why? They knew that you wouldn't miss a meal. So if they insisted that you should worship before having your meal, they ensured that you would worship God before every day. You're not going to miss your meal because you don't want to worship. That was the custom. Like saying grace. That was the custom. And there may be people who are too poor to afford a shrine or things like that. And there may not be a temple within easy reach. And So they invented a new system. It's a beautiful system. In Indian villages, they never bathed at home. There are no bathrooms. It's so warm and plenty of water outside. Lakes and little lakes and small lakes and rivers. And so we all went to the river or the lake to bathe. And after bathing, when you come out, they said, pick up either a stone, or it's usually a bit of clay. Pick up a handful of clay, mold it, put it there, and offer your worship there. You need something to focus your mind on, put it there and do all your worship and prayer, offer all your prayers. When that is finished, sweep the clay back into the river and go on. God doesn't come into being and God does not die. And if God is omnipresent, He is there also. This is not God, definitely not God. It's a printed picture. You can see it. But if God is omnipresent, it is here also. That is the second argument. The first argument is that I need something to focus my attention upon. And the second argument, if God is omnipresent, He is present even there. So they who say that it's a sin to worship a symbol like this, they are denying the omnipresence of God. Then, the next is the fact or the doctrine that each one of these symbols that have been handed down are condensed philosophy. One or two I think we can dispose of quickly. Yeah, vaguely, I think most of you have seen a picture of Krishna. Krishna, Rama, Vishnu and so on are all supposed to be blue. Blue colored. Have you ever seen a blue colored man? No. I've seen black, I've seen yellow, I've seen brown, I've seen white, I've seen pink, especially if somebody blushes. I've never seen a blue-colored person. They say a stillborn child becomes blue-colored. Huh? You see?
When my son was born, I saw him blue.
Right. So, except a stillborn child, I don't think anybody can be blue. And Krishna was supposed to be blue. Rama was supposed to be blue. Vishnu is supposed to be blue. You have seen something very blue, naturally blue, sky. And you look at this sky, you see it blue, not now, overcast. Then you ask yourself, what am I seeing? I'm not seeing blue. It is an optical illusion. I see it and it is not there. I see something which does not exist. I see something which is infinite but which appears to be finite and blue. I see something which is infinite but which appears to be something blue and seems to have a form. One can meditate upon that, just that. Again, there is a formula in one of the Upanishads. How do you describe the absolute, the infinite being? Akashavat sarvagata nitya. How do I meditate upon, how do I contemplate the infinite being? Akashavat sarvagata nitya. Like the sky, all-pervading and eternal. like the sky, all-pervading and eternal. Okay, if you want to meditate upon the sky, please do so. Take a good look and keep meditating upon it. Till you realize that what is blue is illusion and the form is an illusion. When these two disappear, what exists is the truth. If that is simple, you are enlightened already. If that formula appears very simple to you, you are already enlightened. You don't need to struggle at all. You are reading the Yoga Vasishtha now, I think. There is a lovely couplet which occurs two or three times in the Yoga Vasishtha. Brahmasya jagatasyasya jatasya akashavarnavat apuna smaranam manye sadho vismaranam varam. What is this world? It is just like the blueness of the sky. If you think that is an optical illusion, this is also optical illusion. You see it and you know it is not there. And don't say, I see it. It's also not there. Apuna smaranam manye, don't. Oh, it's an illusion. Don't let the thought of the existence of this world arise again in your mind. If you can do that, congratulations, you got it. If you cannot do that, right? If you are not there, and if it is, this is too difficult for you, draw a figure. Nice figure, sweet, beautiful figure, and paint it blue. So the figure is attractive. Krishna is a beautiful form. And so you sit and meditate upon that form. Oh, beautiful, beautiful, lovely. Slowly, the outlines seem to expand and expand and expand and expand, and you seem to enter into it. It's gone. You have entered into the blue, like entering into the infinite sky. That is one method. If that is too difficult, come down to this. And most of these images that you see around you have some kind of philosophy or other. Among these bhaktas or devotees, some painted, made images like this, and others who probably did not like such anthropomorphic figures invented subtler forms. We'll dispose of the second first. They were called the tantrics. But I don't know why they should be called tantrics, because you had the same problem with the Jewish religion. They drew diagrams. Later, even these diagrams became more and more complicated, and the mandalas arose. When the mandalas arose, the devotees who worshipped forms, they thought, well, never mind, we can use the mandalas also and fill those squares and the petals and so on with human figures. So it became more and more complicated. On the one side they were trying to simplify, on the other somebody else was making it more complicated. Because you see, in dialogue, I am tempted to say what I am doing is also what you are doing. So if he corners me and says, I don't worship these human forms, I worship a mandala. I say, no sir, it's the same as me. Yeah, I'll explain to you how.
This is infinite. Nameless, formless, nothing. Pure. And the philosopher said that in that pure, infinite being, there was a bindu, a point,